Hello, welcome to the Longshot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Andy Torbett. Andy is a Scottish underwater explorer, professional cave diver, skydiver, free diver, and climber, filmmaker, TV presenter. This guy's done it all on the outdoor tip. As a TV presenter, he's been on the BBC, The One Show, Coast Operation Iceberg, Operation Cloud Lab, Britain's Ancient Capital, The People Remember, and the children's BBC series, Beyond Bionic, and so much more. Such an interesting life to learn from across the pond. Here is Andy Torbett. All right, I'm here with Andy Torbett, and I have a soft spot for the military, but that's only part of his story. Apparently, jumping out of planes for them wasn't enough. A microcosm of some other part of his life. But I want to get into what built you. I want to get into the beginning. We know your dad kind of like was an influence, right? Must have been. But I want to go, where were you born? And tell us a little bit about, mom and dad.
So I was brought up in the Highlands of Scotland, pretty rural part of the UK, up in the mountains. My dad's side of the family were all miners or coal miners. Back in the day when there was coal mines open in the UK. And he was a forester. So he was, he was just, he cut down trees basically and planted trees. And then my mum's side of the family were farm workers. So that's the kind of, that very kind of rural, outdoors, kind of hands-on working class people. Yeah.
It's funny. I want to know what it was like, as we're talking here on a podcast, it just dawned on me, we were just talking about COVID in the pregame. And, bloody Americans will start talking about their whole life right away, and I'm Jewish. So I'll talk about everything right away, but was your family, what were they like, at the dinner table? Was it quiet? Was it concerned? You're very talkative now, but you've done a lot of podcasts. You've been around the world a lot, I want to get the feel for what it was like at the dinner table.
Yeah, that's an interesting question that I've never been asked before. I always like it on podcasts when people ask me questions I've not been asked before.
Leave it to me.
It does mean that I haven't got a very well prepared answer. Certainly at a reasonably young age, it became just myself, my brother, and my mum. And my mum at the time, again, you don't appreciate it as a kid, but she was working, a lot, a couple of jobs at one point. So often I'd be the first home from school. So even as a kid at primary school, which is, I don't know what the equivalent is in the States, but I would have been about, 10, 11 years old. I'd be first person home. So I'd put the dinner on, so that my brother came home from high school and mum came home from work. The dinner was at least on its way to being ready and mum would finish it off and we'd eat together. And the conversations, I think, were pretty standard. I mean, I'm 46 now. Thinking back that long, I'm not sure I could give an accurate description. But, it was always very supportive. Like my mum, even though she, she came from a sort of a typical working class kind of rural background in North Scotland, she never, no matter how bizarre and kind of, I don't know, unique some of the ideas I'd have for what I want to do for a living. She's like, yep, you go for it, which is unusual because I think back then you tended, it was still this mentality of you go out, you get a job for life or you get a trade and you kind of stay in your station, you stay in your lane. And even as a kid, I suffered from that. I was originally going to join the army at 16, like my brother did. And it never crossed my mind to do anything else. But speaking to the Army recruiting office, they were like, why don't you go to university? And I was like, well, people like me don't go to university. And they're like, no, your grades, you could go to university. And I suffered from the fact that I think it's different now. I think with social media and just the media in general, it doesn't matter where you come from, certainly in the Western world, you're exposed to a million different possibilities. But back then, you kind of, a lot of kids did what their dads did. Like my dad, although he became a forester, most people, their dads were miners, and their sons will become miners. And that's just how it was. Whereas mum was very much like, you want to be a rock star? Go for it. You want to be a professional diver? Go for it. You want to, be a commando? You go for it. You do whatever you think is best because you can do what you don't want to do and still fail at that. So
is that different, for your mom in Scotland, tough area. She just wants you to be safe,
right? What's going on when you were growing up as a kid? Wasn't it a lot going on, when you were probably 10 or 11 years old?
Yeah, Scotland wasn't too bad. I mean, on the west, southwest of Scotland, you had a little bit of spillover from the troubles in Northern Ireland, in Belfast and that stuff. And more in the big cities down south in London and Manchester, some of the bombings. But Scotland, especially North Scotland, you know, up around Aberdeen, was never really touched by any of that. And in fact, Aberdeen itself back in the 80s was booming because of the oil, the North Sea oil. A lot of Americans, most of the population of Aberdeen was English and American, to be honest, because of all the oil workers and the specialists and engineers and that had come out from the States, a lot from places like Texas, actually, Houston. So it wasn't so much that. And I think, I mean, as a kid as well, I started doing a lot of outward bounce stuff. Again, from a sport point of view, I don't play, well, I've started to do a few now, but any competitive sports, because the school I went to, you know, was a very sort of, was a state-funded school, so it was pretty basic. And for various reasons, there wasn't any organized sort of team sports, so football, rugby, any of these sort of things. So I didn't play any team sports, but I was always into the outdoors. So I started, you know, mountain biking, started rock climbing, started diving, all paid for by a paper round, to be honest, because you can do it pretty cheap if you start to build your own kit and perhaps don't use the best kit in the world. And looking back now, some of the stuff I was doing and using was probably more by luck than design that I didn't kill myself. But, so I'd take off to the sea cliffs out past Aberdeen and I'd go solo climbing on my own when I was like 14. And I think my mum worried, but I also think that she understood that the best way to be safe is to understand. I mean, I can think about the process now with a lot more maturity and years of experience in this, but, you know, covering your kids and covering anyone in cotton wool and keeping them super, super safe is not actually a sensible thing to do, because the world can be a dangerous place and eventually they will be exposed to risk. And if they haven't been exposed to risks in the past and able to sort of experiment and work out, you know, still within bounds, but work out how to deal with those risks and assess those risks and then make those risky things safer, then when the dangerous things happen to them, they're not going to have the tools to survive. So I think she understood that. You know,
well, you're a good example of iron sharpens iron. So we're going to get into it. So before we start your journey, I'm going to fast track, how you kind of segued into these things, your relationship with your dad, because he was a forester, what was that relationship like?
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, he took us into the kind of outdoors. People say, how'd you get into the outdoors? Well, I didn't really get into the outdoors as such. I was born and brought up in the Highlands, surrounded by, you know, lochs and rivers and mountains and forests. But my mum took us out. They split up when I was nine or 10. So quite early on. So, you know, the influence I think he had on me in that exposure to the outdoors was, it's nothing I remember like specifically, but I think, you know, it's like as soon as you have a kid, I've got two kids now, and you start teaching them things when they're, a few months old, you expose them to things. They won't remember the specific experiences, but it still impacts on how they work. And bizarrely, it's still something I love now. So again, I live in a forest in the UK, and we don't quite have the kind of wide open spaces that you do in the States and places like, you know, Texas and that. But chopping wood is something I still love doing. You know,
no,
just
kidding.
The simple act of chopping wood. I think it's very therapeutic. It's a very simple process. You know, I mean, it's one of those basic things. It's a man with an axe hitting a big lump of wood again and again and again. But there's something very meditative, I think, and therapeutic about chopping wood.
There's a guy on TikTok that's all he does is chop wood. It's funny because, like, the women, he's an attractive dude. So, like, women will, like, sit there with a split screen and, like, you know, every time he chops a piece of wood, they're, like, dying watching him do it. This guy's gone viral. Okay, so let's get into how you segue, you know, from school to the military and what was that journey like and, you know, some of the dynamics that you ran into in the military.
Yeah, I think initially, you know, as a kid, you know, as most boys do, you know, you play soldiers and you run around with plastic guns and that sort of stuff. And myself and my brother are always going to join the forces. So he actually, and I think partially it was because, you know, I remember the so in the UK there's a big thing that where they closed all the mines or the closed mine or coal mines closed down back in the 80s and everyone was made redundant. So all these little villages, these sort of coal mine villages and towns, were just stripped out. There's just no money there. And one of the ways out of that sort of existence was to join the forces, join the army. You could see the world. It was you got money in your pocket. You got looked after. You got fed and had a roof over your head, that sort of thing. And it had that promise of adventure. And I think for someone like me from that sort of working class background, and again, it's different, I think, these days, but back then the only way for me to get out and see the world, or so I thought, was to join the forces. That's what we did. So my brother joined the army at 16 as a boy soldier. And then he, I tried to do the same thing, and then was advised by the army to go to university. So I said, look, okay, if I'm going to go to university, because that could help your sort of promotion and that sort of thing. So I said, well, if I'm going to go to university, I might as well study something that I'm interested in rather than anything vocational, because I don't want to be a doctor or an engineer in the army or anything like that. I want to be a soldier. So I studied zoology and archaeology. So, lions and sharks and, things like that. And the evolution of man, which I loved. A lot of people would think like essays or work was work, and I was really interested in it. It was like, for me, it was like watching like David Attenborough programs on the TV. I used to enjoy going to lectures, but even through then, I was still going to always join, the forces. So I did. I joined at age 20. So I finished my degree just before I turned 19. Because I went to university when I just turned 17. Wow. Because I had the grades to get in. And then spent 10 years in the forces. And originally I was in the Royal Marine Commandos, but I broke my back and they thought that was probably unfixable, which is understandable. That I don't hold any grudge with that. It's a perfectly sensible kind of diagnosis.
How'd you break your back?
On a training exercise, I fell on an assault course and it wasn't so much the damage to the bones. It sounds quite dramatic, but it was actually the damage to the sort of discs. The problem, and it's still something. Even now, I for my work, I have to be reasonably fit to for the work I do, both the adventure side of things and also for the stunt work and TV and stuff like that. But I still have to commit time to managing that and making sure I'm flexible and I'm mobile and I'm doing stuff to prevent that back from sort of locking up. So yeah, and at that point, I managed to get myself reasonably fit and convince the army to take me on under certain caveats. But then, long story short, I've actually proved myself completely fit by passing P Company, which is the airborne selection course. It's kind of like, I think, Vuoversa Rangers, I think would be the US equivalent. And then I did bomb disposal for quite a lot of time.
That's intense. I mean, what is that? We're talking Hurt Locker with Jeremy Renner?
Yeah.
I've
never seen the film, but I've heard about it.
Oh my God. I mean, well, I'll tell you, do a little scene for you. There's a scene, a famous actor, I forgot, he goes up to him. And these guys, and I want to hear how you did it, but this guy dismantles a bomb. And it's, it's under duress and big time. And he does it, in dramatic fashion. And the leading officer says, "Who's the bomb guy? You're the bomb guy?" He said, "You're the bomb guy. You're the bomb guy, huh? That's just hot shit. That's just hot." It's a funny scene. He's like, it's the best scene in the whole movie, I think. And he's like, "How does one go about dismantling one of these things?" And he goes, "The way you don't die, sir." He's like, "Yeah, you're hot shit." He goes, "That's a madman. That's a true madman talking right there." And you got to be a little bit of a madman to do that a little bit. But can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Yeah. So I did bomb this with him. So I was in the commando airborne bomb disposal squadron, so everyone was commandos, paras, SF support, and we also did an underwater section. So the way it works in the UK is the Navy have mine clearance divers. They take care of sort of bomb disposal in the sea, if at the high water mark and below in the sea, and the Army do things like rivers and lakes and unfortunately sewers as well, which is always pleasant. But it's bizarre that the outside perception, like a lot of things I do now, skydiving, cave diving, stunt work, the outside perception is that everyone is, Red Bull drinking, maniacs, high-fiving, just like living life on the edge, And the exact opposite is true. It's a very cerebral undertaking. It's a very psychological and intellectual process. You don't have to be the fittest soldier in the world, or it's a case of, and you know, the course itself is months long, and it's very educational. It's very classroom based. You know, do some practical stuff, but it's not about who can run the fastest or carry the most weight. It's about studying, understanding two things: the technical aspect of understanding how bombs work and all that sort of stuff, and the many different varieties that you get. But more than that, it hammers home this, along with a course that a number of the bomb guys go and do, which is a high risk search. As the name suggests, it's you know, conducting very high risk searches. Often counter-terrorist sort of based. And the both courses drive home, the key is accurate threat assessment. So, you know, in civilian parlance, it's basically a risk assessment. That's what you're doing. You're doing a risk assessment. If you do that accurately and then base your plan on that, you'll be okay. Because, and the idea is always to go home at the end of the day. Yeah, that's what we're trying to achieve. You're trying to defuse a bomb, but you're also trying to make sure you go home and no one gets hurt. So, you know, it's all about as much as you can, and sometimes you can't. Sometimes it's just as dangerous as it is. But what you're trying to do is make it as safe as possible. Which is why, if you find a bomb and it's in the middle of like Iraq, for example, in the middle of the desert, right? Great. You walk up to it, and you're not going to set it off by walking up to it. It's not a booby trap. It's just a mortar that hasn't gone off for some reason. So it's hot. So if you handle it, it might go off. You walk up to it. You place a small charge next to it, but not touching it, and then you back off to a safe distance and you blow it in situ. There we go. Safe as houses. You know, there's no need to be cutting red and blue wires unless there is an imperative for doing that, because after that is risking your life. So if you can avoid risking you or anyone else's life, then you take that, the safest route to achieve the mission. And the other thing I'd say that people often find surprising, and this is not me, this is every bomb disposal officer I have known that we've spoken about this, it's an incredibly zen experience. It's actually quite peaceful. And the reason is this, is that regardless of rank, most bomb disposal officers working in the British forces, Iraq, Afghanistan, were either sergeants or staff sergeants or young officers, or lieutenants or captains, junior captains. So quite, you know, but you were the subject matter expert. You were in control of that site. So you would be calling up, like, for example, the head of the Air Force for Iraq, so the chief guy in charge of the Air Force for the whole of Iraq, for the British area, and you want a no-fly zone over this area. You then you speak to some major or colonel and telling him to set up a perimeter of his troops around this area to keep everyone out, blah, blah, blah. You'd be giving orders that all these people are far senior than you. You'd be handling this, handling that, da-da-da-da-da. You'd brief your team, prep this kit, this is what I'm going to do, da-da-da. And then around the bomb, depending on the size of the explosive device, depends on how big the sort of no-go zone is. But the only person that goes into that no-go zone is the bomb disposal officer. It's like this little bubble that's closed off from the rest of the world. So you're there, you're on the comms, you're on the three or four different nets, talking to like majors and colonels and, you know, air marshals and all this sort of stuff. And then as soon as you step over that line, it's just peace. It's just you. And they go, thank God for that. And you just take the long walk. You walk on down to the device.
Aren't you wearing heavy armor too? So it's a kind of quiet in there, but you can hear your own breathing, and that's it.
You can do it. It depends that the sort of armor that I've seen posters for the Hurt Locker, that body armor is useful depending on the size of the device. So, for example, in the UK, we still uncover a lot of German World War II airdropped munitions. Often in places like London, when they're doing big renovations, like Canary Wharf was a famous one, they're completely changing it. So all this work's going on, this huge area. And they're digging up these 500-pound, 1,000-pound bombs that were dropped during World War II. Like they hit the mud, sank right in, you know, near the Thames, very, very muddy area. And then things were built over the top of it over the years. And these things are still pretty dangerous. And 1,000 pounds, you know, that's gonna ruin your day. So when we've dealt with them in the past, you go down there in, you know, normal combat boots, combat trousers, and a t-shirt if it's a warm, sunny day. And you sit on it comfortably and you deal with the fuse at the front and you sit on the bomb cowboy style. Because the thing is,
like Slim Pickens and Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah,
are you familiar with that reference?
I am. Yeah. On the bomb. Pretty much. Obviously, the fuse, for the best way to do the fuse is to sit on the bomb facing forwards, then just lean forward over the fuse at the front. And the thing is, it's a 1,000-pound bomb, right? If it goes off, doesn't matter how much armor you're wearing. It's irrelevant. Right. So you might as well be comfortable. Hence, combat trousers and t-shirt on a hot day.
How long did you do that for?
Bomb disposal.
Yeah.
God, 6 years, six, 7 years.
So 6 out of the 10 years you're in the military. That was a big bulk of that.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff I did was in there. And even the commando and power stuff, I was doing like para bomb disposal or underwater bomb disposal. Even the specialist stuff that I do, like the range, that would be effectively like doing bomb disposal within the ranges, I think would be probably the example from a US point of view. But yeah, and it was great. It was very, we're very busy. In fact, it's one of the few parts of the British forces that's expanded over the years. Now we've got two bomb disposal regiments because we were so busy. You know, you're carrying pagers because back in the day, you know, we still had pagers. That was still a thing back then. And I mean, I spent 2 years of my life on 3 hours notice to move when I wasn't on tour. And I loved it. I absolutely, and that's the thing. I think more and more people, veterans are coming out now and they're feeling more comfortable about saying, admitting to the fact that actually we loved it. Like I loved going on tour. I loved the simplicity. And I'm not saying that places like Iraq, Afghanistan and Bosnia and Kosovo, all these places I went to, weren't hard places, weren't, and they had the horrific stuff going on. But again, there's a certain kind of peace that comes with, you know what you're there, you know what they're there to do, and you know who's around you. You get up in the morning and you've got a routine, and this is what you're going to go and do, and this is why you're here. And the rest of the world just doesn't matter. And I was single through this whole time, which helped a lot. But you know, I think that's one of the things people struggle with when they leave the forces or even come home on tour from tours. It's the peace that they struggle with, not the war. You know, it's that's the problem. That kind of, I don't know, when I left the force, certainly in the first year, I was just drifting in the wind. I just, you know, I just didn't know what to do with myself. Because you've lost this little community, this little tribe of people, just this band of brothers, if you will, around you, that whether you like them or not, you can trust them. And yeah, that's not quite the same initially anyway, when you leave the forces.
So it's such an interesting dynamic at this 10-year mark to where you've done this. First of all, why, what caused you to finally, you know, leave the military? And then what does that segue look like to, you know, the peacefulness into, I can't describe what you're going to do next is somewhat peaceful. It seems more frenetic and adventurous, but why did you leave? And let's talk about that time and what was going on with you and then how you transitioned into this interesting part of your career.
Yeah. So with the forces, you know, you eventually get promoted behind a desk, whether you're a sergeant major, if you go that stream, or whether you're a major, if you're an officer stream, but you're promoted further and further back from the action. And I was lucky. I was getting promoted, but managed to find sort of specialist roles that I could stay on the coal face, if you will, because I never joined the forces to, you know, sit behind a desk. And at an age of 30, and it's not just me, we tend to hemorrhage sort of soldiers from the age of kind of, you know, 30, 32, because they're like, I just don't want to, I never joined the army to sit behind a desk. But the same token, you know, you get older, you know, and 32 is relatively old in the army, and you have to make space to the guys coming up behind you who want your job. And that's absolutely fair enough. You can't stick in one job forever. So it got to the point where, and again, I don't hold the forces with any sort of malice or I don't have any problem with how it was. That's how it was. I got older and I got promoted, and you've got to either stay in and, as I say, become a sort of sit behind a desk or you get out. And I wasn't prepared then. And to be honest, even now, you know, at 46, I still don't have a desk job. So yeah, I got out and, you know, I had this grand idea to live this life of adventure. And I think with the first year, I was just sort of drifting. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I, you know, you find yourself going to bed very late and getting up very late and just, I don't know, not just drifting in the wind really. And then obviously to make ends meet, I started working in the ex-forces market, as a lot of the guys do, you know, working out in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and West Africa. But during the periods off, because you might do sort of a month, 6 weeks on, and then sort of 4 weeks off, I'd start doing more little projects, adventure projects, mostly around diving. Diving is what I do best, also climbing things, canoeing, eventually skydiving. And I realized that if you want to make a living from the sort of adventure side of things and exploration and that, you need to communicate it. And it was no different to back in the Victorian times when, you know, people would go into these big epic adventures and expeditions to the Nile and Africa. They'd come back and they'd give talks at, you know, the Royal Geographic Society and et cetera, et cetera. So it was kind of the modern version of that. So I started writing for diving magazines initially, because diving was what I did best. And then other outdoor sports magazines, and I started doing talks at some of the dive shows, dive festivals, outdoor festivals that were going on, get a little bit of sponsorship, and then I started dealing with some safety work for documentaries for like wildlife, BBC mainly underwater safety, climbing safety for them, and that eventually evolved into presenting. So I started doing a bit of TV presenting on mostly BBC stuff, science and wildlife, but again, always, you know, not because I'm in any way a particularly gifted TV presenter, but because I had a certain skill set that allowed me to access places that otherwise they couldn't get to. So, you know, they'd wheel me in like the monkey they would send into space when they couldn't find anyone else better at presenting to do the job. So, you know, cave diving, or we dive Britannic, which is Titanic's twin sister, which lies 400 feet down in the Aegean Sea. Well, there's not that many BBC presenters who can dive to 400 feet because you're using mixed gases and rebreathers and all that sort of technical diving stuff.
When did that sink?
Sorry?
Britannic, it's a ship that sunk, right? When did that sink?
It's the twin sister of Titanic, and it sank in 1916 when it was being used as a hospital ship in World War One. So it sailed back and forth from Britain to the Mediterranean, picking up troops from like Gallipoli and things like that. And then on its fifth voyage, it hit a German submarine-laid sea mine. But everyone got off alive. Everyone exited alive. One of the lifeboats actually got churned up in the propellers. But it's you know, it's one of those things people say, oh, bloody hell, you know, another one of Titanic's ships sank, you know. It's like, well, it did sink, but it did hit, you know, a device that was designed to sink warships.
Right.
Give it.
That's interesting. Your path, real quick, is interesting. How did you just figured that that's the way they did it, and, you know, when they went on safari, and it's like, well, that's the way I'm going to promote myself. What year was this?
I think I wrote my first article in 2010, okay. 2009, 2010.
So just before the wave of, like, you know, Instagram and Facebook and all that, to where you're already building this. So by the time that comes along, I mean, that had to be a huge needle mover for you for when, you know, social media came around.
Yeah, I still am behind the curve on social media. I really am. Really? You know, I'm still very much on print. When I first started, print media was still king, like magazines were still king, you know, in the US, like magazines like Outside was still huge, these big kind of adventure magazines. And I got into it by, I'm a great, great believer in, you know, don't just put your money where your mouth is, go and spend your money first before you start gobbing off, basically. You know, a lot of people are telling me what they're going to do. They're going to tell me how great they're going to be. And it's like, go and do it and then tell me how great you were. That's what I prefer to do. So the magazines, and the magazines was very much the first step, which then rolled everything onwards. But what I thought was like, I'm an ex-squaddie, you know, I'm an ex-veteran. I'm a veteran. I've got no journalistic background. Why on earth would an editor want anything off me, you know, or commission anything from me, you know? So rather than write letters saying, oh, I want to write for you, would you like me to write for you? I thought, I'll come up with an idea, so it's a little bit different, and I'll go and do it, and I'll take photographs, and I'll write it up, and then I'll start knocking on doors and go, right, guys, this is what I've got. Would you like to buy this off me? And fortunately, the first door I knocked on said yes, and then straight after, it was like, right, what else you got? I was like, oh, I was thinking of maybe doing this thing on, you know, diving in rivers. Oh, I love it. Brilliant. I've not done it before. Okay, cool. The editor actually lent me his underwater camera because I didn't have because they're very expensive, the housings and that. So he lent me he was good enough to lend me his very expensive camera and housing and lighting setup to go and do that. And things kind of rolled from there, but I've always been a proponent of, you know, that's the way to start. So if I've approached a sponsor, I mean, sometimes sponsors have approached me. I've been very fortunate. Like, I work with Panerai at the moment, a watch company, and they approached me. But a lot of the other sponsors, I've approached them. But how I've done it is, I go, right, guys, for example, take a diving one. These are the diving magazines I've written for in the last 6 months, and this is how the readership. Here's the talks I've given, and how many people attended. This is the telly I've done. How many viewers they had. Blah blah blah. So they can go okay, and they can put a sort of quantifiable marketing dollar sign next to that, and see if I'm worth. You know, too many people I think knock on people's doors and go, "Oh, I'm great. Give me money." It's like no. Life. No one owes you a living. Get off your backside and start working for it.
Right. Don't tell show. So let's go into the milestones that like just rattle off some of these amazing milestones. I see this guy, you know, it's like he's got ants in his pants, so to speak, you know, after the military, you know, you have, because there's an adrenaline rush, you know, when you're in the military, you're jumping out of planes, your bomb experience, just the whole thing. So let's rattle off some of the milestones, give people an idea of like, all these things that you know end up doing on this part of the journey.
So yeah, I left the army what 2006, and then I think wrote my first article 2009 actually. Gave my first public talk was 2009. Started TV presenting 2011. What else, you know?
But the adventures though, you're talking about those experiences.
Expedition to Greenland, doing like ice cave diving and ice climbing around icebergs and on Greenland, the glaciers there. You know, I've done hey-ho jumps for science over the Arizona desert, jumping like 28,000 feet and actually in free fall, trying to get air, trying to get samples on the way down, things like that. I mean, diving is the big one. So Britannic was a big dive to 400 feet. I've done a lot of cave diving exploration over the years. I do a lot of cave diving. And I think the reason that I compete, so I'm just back from Arizona again, bizarrely, in October in 2022 to compete at the World Skydiving Championships for Team GB, speed skydiving, which is exactly what it sounds. There's a number of disciplines in skydiving, and speed skydiving is the easiest one to explain to non-skydivers, because usually what you do is you go, what do you think it is? And they're like, I don't know, is it like the fastest person wins? Yes, that is exactly it. You jump up a plane and the fastest person wins. So in fact, Marco Hepp has just broken the world record in Arizona last October. And I think he did, speed skydiving started in Europe, so it's done in kilometers. So he did 526 kilometers an hour, which I think is about 315 miles an hour, head down towards the earth. Yeah, it's pretty fast. So yeah, there's that. But I think the reason I love these things is because much like the military, much like one of the things I loved about bomb disposal, especially, or tours, you know, where there's this imminent threat, is that it requires you to bring your A game and nothing else will do. And it, you know, and I think even from an evolutionary point of view, we as humans, you know, we would go out and we would risk our lives to hunt game, or we'd risk our lives avoiding predators. But I think we are wired to, not all the time, but in certain infrequent times, have to deal with high stress, high risk situations. And if there's not a certain peace in that moment, there is a peace before and afterwards, definitely comes from that. And yes, and as a motivator, because if you don't have these things, then kind of what's the point? Like, you know, people ask me, oh, yeah, you stay very motivated, even in your 40s, you know, you're still training every day in the gym. And I'm like, well, yeah, but I have to, you know, because I now work in stunts, a lot of like Hollywood movie stunts. You know, I worked on Bond and I worked on Fast and Furious and these sort of things. And you're required to be physically fit and physically sort of robust for that work. You have to be. The cave diving I do, for the skydiving I do, for the climbing I do, you know, being fit and able is a survival tool, quite frankly. So it's not a matter of motivation, it's a requirement for what I do.
Listening though, that's a part of your DNA. That's a part of your life at this point. You know, it's not something you really tell yourself you have to do. It's just something that you do. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's true. I think it is. And you're right, because I don't have to do it, because if I chose to not cave dive and you know do exploration projects and skydive, and I could not do stunts, I could go and get a desk job, and then I wouldn't have to train every day. But I think I would go slowly insane. I'm aware that the outside perception, people are probably listening to this going, mate, you're mental as it is. But I would argue against that. And I do.
Not the American audience. I'd be like, I like this dude. I appreciate what he's saying, because, you know, this is what people are driving in their car that, you know, stuck at their, you know, work and, you know, 9 to 5 going, man, I mean, that stuff that you just rattled off, you know, I had to pull it out of you a little bit, but that's like rarefied air, no pun intended, you know? So, you know, that's not, you know, that's an adventure people dream of. So.
Yeah. I'm aware that my life is unusual, and I'm fortunate to be in this position, but I would avoid using the phrase luck, because it's nothing to do with luck. You know, I've had a little bit of luck along the way. Of course you do. But, you know, I have chosen this and I've made this happen. So it's, and I think that it doesn't necessarily be your entire life. I've got friends, one of my main cave diving friends. We do a lot of cave diving projects and exploration projects together. You know, he works in IT, Monday to Friday, works in IT. In the weekends, we train, we do some cave diving, and then he takes a holiday once a year for a couple of weeks, and we go off somewhere, and we you know, we're pushing. And these are some pretty hardcore things. We're diving in maybe 2-3 miles. You're swimming in an underwater cave that's maybe miles long. You then surface in a chamber, an air chamber, so a little, like, little cave, air cave, that's completely cut off from the outside world. And out of your dry tube, a big aluminium tube, you pull out your camping gear, your sleeping bag, your stove, and you're camping in that cave for days, diving in other sections. So you're underground, underwater for days and days on end. You may as well be in the moon. You know, and he works
where,
in IT.
Where is this? Where is that, that you did that?
The last one we did was in France. We've got some other projects. I mean, he's just back from one in Mexico. Another friend of mine is off to one in Australia. But I mean, you know, people say it's hard and harder to be a genuine explorer, to find, you know, in the age of Google Maps and all this sort of stuff, to find new places that human beings have not been or seen before. But actually, if you go underwater, and especially underwater underground, it's actually really easy. I mean, during COVID, there's a little cave just across the river from me here in the UK. So the UK is a tiny island, and it's very heavily populated, very, very densely populated. And I was finding new underwater and dry chambers that no human being even knew existed in right here in the UK in 2021, you know. So it's almost easy to be an explorer if you go underwater, because it's
yeah, pretty... water. I mean, that's something like they're not Google mapping that right now.
Yeah. So what's also nice is that these are things at the moment, the technology doesn't exist. We can't send ROVs or drones or robots into these, like, miles of underwater of cave systems. Currently, the only thing that exists that can map and sort of discover these systems are human beings, which
what
is
a
nice.
Wonderful, you know, a part of the planet that we haven't seen yet. That, because everybody can, you know, visit, you know, any part of the world, but the water is, you know, there's so many, you know, unique things. It's fascinating. I never really thought of that. It'd be silly for me not to ask this. I need to know, what are some of the 2 or 3 craziest experiences that you've, you know, that are highlight your brain? It's like, yeah, that's one of them. You know, that was crazy, or that was just wild, or surprises.
For a BBC series, they asked me to race a peregrine falcon. So a peregrine falcon is the fastest animal in the world. And in a stoop, so a head down dive towards prey, it'll achieve 2 miles an hour. I think that's the fastest ever been recorded by scientists. So the idea was to do a speed skydive to try and beat the peregrine falcon. However, but it was actually a children's BBC series. It's like a children's science and wildlife series. So we had to make sure, at least initially, I couldn't quite. Now, see, I can speed skydive faster than that. But we kind of, you know, first attempt, I kind of failed. So because they want to bring in technology, because the whole premise of the program was to look at if man and machine can compete against these superheroes of the animal world. So a friend of mine at the UK Space Agency designed and built me these prototype, effectively jet engines that I, thigh mounted jet engines that I strapped to my legs. The idea being that I jump out the plane, I go head down, I start speed skydiving, and then I'd a little bite switch in my mouth, because my hands are by my side, kind of controlling my stability when I'm in free fall. So I'd bite down on the switch and it would turn the engines on and give me a little boost, and that would rocket me past the peregrine falcon. So that was interesting.
That's crazy. That's okay. Wild.
Yeah.
So I mean, that, you know, how does the, I'm trying to figure out how does the Falcon, how is this, why is he racing you? Why doesn't he just fly away? How does that even work?
Well, in the end, what they had to do was that because we couldn't, I think from a sort of wildlife, you know, care point of view, we didn't, we did a timed race. So effectively they clocked my speed and they clocked the Peregrine Falcon speed. So we weren't racing physically head to head.
Okay.
Because we couldn't, to be fair, although I beat the Peregrine Falcon in the end, I still maintain that, you know, it can do things that I can't, because in order to achieve those speeds, I was jumping from like 15,000 feet, whereas the Peregrine Falcon can achieve those speeds from like 800 feet. So its actual acceleration is far better than mine, because it can go from basically zero to 250 miles an hour in hundreds of feet, whereas I was taking thousands and thousands of feet to achieve the same thing.
That's a good one. Where are you at today? Like, what's going on with you right now, your career?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to write a book at the moment. Well, I'm trying to write at least the initial parts of a book to try and tout round publishers. And it's about actually dealing with risk and dealing with fear. Because I've realized that I was going to ask a lot of questions about this sort of thing, how I deal with risk and how I deal with, you know, fear, because I'm not a sociopath or a psychopath. I get the same way as everybody else does. And I can realize through my, but since the age of 20, dealing with high risk situations, be it bomb disposal or someone shooting at you or trying to blow you up, or cave diving or speed skydiving, that I might have something useful. So I was encouraged so I'm working on that at the moment. I mean, I've got the sort of Hollywood movie stunt work is always coming in. I'm on next week with some friends. What I love about the stunt community here in the UK, especially, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but when I first started working in this sort of movie stunt world, it was a bit like being back in the army, in the sense that it's quite a small group of people, very highly skilled, very highly motivated, but they look after each other. It's a really close-knit community, and that's the first time I felt that way since I left the forces. It was lovely to have people who you think, yeah, these guys have got my back, they're actually looking after me here. That was one of the reasons, actually, when I started doing it on, it was Bond, I really started working on James Bond, the last James Bond film. I was like, yeah, I want to keep working in this. Not maybe all the time, I've got my own projects to go and do, but I would like working with these people. These are decent human beings, highly motivated, highly professional, and I like this environment.
Right, so, yeah, they take pride in being, you know, my experience with stuntmen is there is a camaraderie there, and they take it by the book, you know. It's like, we don't, you know, like every single, you know, parameter and rule is there for a reason. And, you know, they want it, you know, like if you ever seen the movie, to reference a movie, The Last Samurai, how, you know, when Tom Cruise falls in love with the samurai and they do everything to perfection, you could say, you know, most stuntmen, you know, professional or working on the big films, you know, have that type of mentality to do things to the best, to their ability. It's an art form.
And it's a very similar between stunts, between the sort of the top level cave divers, top level skydivers, and the top level sort of operators in the military. It's this mentality of, you know, these people aren't cowboys and they're not adrenaline junkies. They're all very considered, cautious individuals who look at the risks and go, right, how can we make this as safe as possible? And certainly the stunt world, more so, because, you know, there's times in the forces, yes, there's times in the forces where, you know, you have to just suck it up and your life's on the line. But today, whether you're making a TV documentary, making a movie, it's not worth dying for, and it's not worth getting hurt or hurting anyone else for, you know. So there's definitely this mentality, certainly in the stunt world now, where, you know, the absolute priority is not to get the shot. The absolute priority is to make sure that everyone goes home with all their legs and arms attached at the end of the day. That's how the best people operate.
Right. Big news here is that, you know, what happened with Alec Baldwin, that was a low budget shoot, but, you know, the majority of these bigger budget films, you know, you get the best, you know, stunt, you know, crew in there, and it's great to watch. It's great to watch, you know, anything on a high level, but they're really take seriously, and they're paid really well too, you know? So, you know, great,
that's true.
Great, great PL. I love stuntmen, stunt people. So What do you have planned on your 5 to 10, 15 year plan? What lies ahead?
Well, I mean, we're still hopefully working in stunts. We've got some documentaries on the way, hopefully cave diving ones. If say 5 years time, I still want to be cave diving. It's getting harder and harder. It's getting harder and harder work because just finding new places that people haven't been is becoming more and more arduous. I think I'd like to write more. I've always enjoyed writing, even if when I first started writing magazine articles, I thought it came quite easy to me. So I do enjoy writing. In fact, I was in the gym today. I have my best ideas when I'm in the gym. So I've got a home gym and I've got a whiteboard up. So I'm always writing things on that. And I, for a sec, I haven't even finished writing the pitch for the first book and I'm already writing ideas for the second book now.
What a great idea to put a whiteboard in your gym, because your body is it. You're in state. You're in yes. physical state. Your blood is pumping. Your adrenaline's going. Your dopamine is high. And then you have a whiteboard there. You're looking at it. You're staying focused. And also, you're writing stuff down with your marker, a marker whiteboard. There's a reason why I'm asking. This is valuable shit. This is really great.
So what I do is I've got two whiteboards. I've got a big whiteboard and a small whiteboard because the big ones were quite big enough. Sometimes it looks a bit like the scrolling of a madman, because just like I've got three or four different colors and markers and there should be a system, but there's not. I just grab the first ones. There's all these ideas in red and purple and black and blue all over the place. And often I listen to podcasts as well when I'm in the gym. You know, I find that often can be even more inspiring and motivating than music. So, you know, one of the podcast guests or the host will say something like, I like that. Or perhaps with a book, I'm trying to explain something and they say like, that's a better way of explaining it than I'm trying to do. So I'll take a note of the podcast and the time and date, or sort of, you know, timestamp and who said it as well. Because I always like to give credit if I'm going to end up using that. But yeah, again, with ideas, I always find that when you're training, the blood's pumping to your brain, you're sort of on fire. And sometimes some of my best ideas of things go on the whiteboard.
And you're looking at them. This is valuable. Yeah. You're looking, you're not just like, because everybody was like, well, you know, you could dictate in your cell phone. But you're looking at it every day when you're working out. There's a lot of value in that. I can get into that, you know, deeper, but I'm not going to. But that's fascinating.
Well, yeah, I find that if I write things in a notebook, it's very easy, as you say, to close the notebook or turn the page and forget all about it. Whereas I don't think rub things off the whiteboard until I've either done them or until I've spent a decent amount of time considering and going, okay, that isn't such a great idea. I'll have to leave that one and wipe it off. But yeah, there's ideas up there that have been up there for months probably, but they're still there and I still see them every time I go in the gym. You know, so they still almost stay in the forefront of your mind.
I'm going to close with a nice compliment here. You know, listen to that last part, the whiteboard. This encapsulates your personality. If you think that there's value here with somebody, you know how you know that Andy is really good at what he does? Is because he's alive. I mean, think about everything that we just talked about. You know, I was like, you know, this one little, you know, paradigm shift, and we're not talking today. So I think that should be examined and modeled. Yeah, Andy, please tell everybody how they could find out more about you.
Social media wise, the only one I really use is Instagram, which is just Andy Torbett on Instagram. I've got a website, which is andytorbett.com. However, it hasn't been updated in about 3 or 4 years. So I am getting around to it. Give me a few weeks at least before you go on that website. Otherwise, it'll all be a bit out of date. And that's pretty much it. But yeah, if people actually want to drop me a line, they can either do through the website. But to be honest, the best way is just drop me a line through Instagram and, you know, say hi.
Andy Torbett, thank you so much for sharing. Truly fascinating, awesome stories.
Thank you, man.
That was Scottish underwater explorer, professional cave diver, skydiver, free diver, climber, filmmaker, TV presenter, and military extraordinaire Andy Torbett. Here's the great quote for him. Because in the end, you won't remember the times you spent in the office or mowing the lawn. Climb that goddamn mountain. Jack Kerouac, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right, have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, Give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right, thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.